Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today grew up in South Africa, where he began his career in law. He then completed a master's at Cambridge and Columbia Law School and spent decades working as a corporate lawyer in London and New York before returning to South Africa to turn his hand to creative writing. Since then, he's been awarded several literary prizes, including the University of Johannesburg Debut Prize and a South African Literary Award for the Afrikaans version of his 2015 collection of short stories, The Alphabet of Birds. Now living in Cape Town, his second book, The Third Reel, explores the Cold War, sexual freedom and politics, the anti-apartheid movement, modern art, film and photography. As I welcomed S.J. Nordea, usually known as Fani, to the programme, which was recorded amidst the buzz of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, I began by asking him to tell us about his full name.
Fani Nordea.
What is S.J. stand for?
That stands for the full Afrikaans names with their male Latin endings, namely Stephanus Jacobus. And Fani is a contraction of the middle syllable of Stephanus.
So you're Afrikaans?
I am. I'm Afrikaans speaking, yes. That was my first language, at least. I spent much of my adult life outside South Africa, but Afrikaans is still my first language, yes.
It's a very much a minority group.
It is indeed. There are actually surprisingly many Afrikaans speakers in South Africa. And these days, the majority of them are not white. Often Afrikaans is associated with white South Africans and, alas, particularly with apartheid, probably hopefully less so these days. But yes, it's still a minority language spoken as a first language, probably by not many more than about 4.5 million people.
So talking about apartheid, of course, that's something that must have loomed large in your upbringing. Just give me the timeline politically.
Sure. So I was born in 1970. I spent my entire youth, my entire early life, you know, living in a white suburban South Africa. It was a very odd time. One's life probably didn't look that much different in some respects from a life in the Midwest of America. You know, one had this fantasy of living in a white country. One went to white schools. I think the first time I ever was in an educational environment which wasn't all white was when I went to university in South Africa. And that was the 80s, and it was a time of political upheaval, but also the time of great suppression of information. So only then did one get in touch with other people which had similar sort of more leftist political instincts. Also, I guess growing up as a queer white child in South Africa in those circumstances, going to an all-white Afrikaans-speaking boys' school, one had an instinct that more or less all of this was wrong. You know, one felt off kilter much of the time. And as early as I could, I escaped by getting scholarships to study first in the UK and then in the US. And then I spent much of my adult life first in New York and then in London.
Should you have gone into the army?
Absolutely. Back when I was leaving high school, one could go to university first. So I avoided conscription by going to university. And fortunately, by the time I had finished university, so my first degree in South Africa, it had been abolished. So I only just missed it.
You made passing reference to being a queer child. How difficult was it dealing with different sexuality in that environment?
Extremely difficult, I think. In a sense, I want to step back from it immediately because I think being a privileged white queer child was still very different than being a child of any other color. So the degrees of difficulty in South Africa, I don't want to sort of make it sound like victimhood, but there was certainly a kind of brutality about South African culture at that time. You know, the blueprint was very narrow about how one should be and how masculinity was supposed to work, how one could be a man in that world. So it's only really, in a sense, in retrospect that one gets a good view of or gets a good perspective on how constraining and anxiety-inducing it certainly was, you know, and then obviously the fear of being discovered or found out.
On top of that, I wanted just to explore that feeling of being a white from Africa, and particularly South Africa, which I think it's even more intense than being, like me, a white from Zimbabwe, that sense of, so do you really belong?
Maybe I should start by saying that me personally, having spent so much time outside South Africa, I have a pretty complex sort of multiple identity, the containing of multitudes sounds like something like a pretty apt sort of phrase. Yes, and it's a matter of national discourse, of course, whether white South Africans belong and to which extent they belong, to which extent they're African, to which extent the language I'm speaking, Afrikaans, is either an African language or a pure European language or a mishmash. Afrikaans, of course, has all these influences of various African languages, of the Malay spoken by Malay slaves who were imported into South Africa in the 18th century. And then the most likely history of Afrikaans, of course, is that it developed out of the Pidgin Dutch that was being spoken by slaves who were trying to speak the language of their masters. So one's identity and one's language is both that of colonizer and colonized. You know, the people of continental descent in South Africa were also colonized very much by the Brits. The language of Afrikaans was sort of viewed with colonial disdain by the British colonizers in South Africa. But then my ancestors were also people who, after 1948, when they gained political power, perfected racial segregation, which was really, to an extent, an invention of the British class system in South Africa. But then, yes, my ancestors were vehement racists. It's a very odd position, and as I say, even now in South Africa, with the sense that whites have in various ways retained all kinds of privilege, at least economic privilege, if not political control. And so there's a whole new conversation around the language of Afrikaans and how it fits there and whether it does fit there, and the position of white South Africans and how they should be working to give up their white privilege. So it's a question of belonging and not belonging at the same time, I think.
And those are themes that come up in your latest book, The Third Reel, which we'll talk about in more detail in a moment. As you say, you went to university and then you escaped. You got out, going off to Cambridge and to Columbia.
Yes, that's right. So I was a lawyer. I think it seemed as if law was a more useful vehicle to escape South Africa, that sort of professional trajectory, rather than, for instance, studying literature, although I did, as an undergraduate, study Dutch and Afrikaans literature as well. And then did a postgraduate law degree at Cambridge, and then did the same thing at Columbia. Spent 7 years flitting around studying on scholarships or public money. And then I became a legal practitioner of the most extreme environment for that sort of thing. You know, joined a big New York law firm where I was a corporate lawyer, sitting in conference rooms until 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes. And then did the same in London for a long time until I reached the point where I felt very, I think, removed from myself, quite alienated from myself. And then decided to give it all up, to leave the UK, to leave law behind, to end a 10-year relationship at that time, to go back to South Africa where I hardly had any ties anymore, and then to do the marginal thing of writing literary fiction in Afrikaans to boot at the southern edge of the world.
It seems like an insane decision.
To me it feels very, very sane, and I'm certainly a far happier person than I was when I was being a corporate lawyer in the Northern Hemisphere. So to my mind, it's a pretty rational thing to do. My sort of friends and colleagues in the financial world in London didn't really understand what I was doing.
Where did the writing come from? Had you been writing all the time?
I did write as a young person when I was a student, but then that really was displaced entirely during the years that I was practicing as a lawyer. I think the psychological frequency is just in such a different, when it's psychologically at such a different frequency, it's not just time but a certain kind of mind space that was radically missing. And then it was a bit like a blocked pipe being unblocked, and there was sort of a gushing of the writing. When I allowed myself to do so, I've described it as being almost like writing in a state of automatism. It really, especially in the first year or two, it just sort of flowed. Using the cliche, the stories, because they weren't short stories at the time, just wrote themselves, as it were.
Tell me about language, because you initially wrote entirely in Afrikaans.
Yes, my first book was, oddly, it was written mostly in Afrikaans. except for dialogue, because I had been away from South Africa for such a long time that I really had no sense of how people would speak Afrikaans anymore. I had hardly spoken it myself in those 16 years. Narrative parts were written in Afrikaans, and then dialogue was written in English, and then I would translate the English back into Afrikaans. And then I translated all of the Afrikaans into English. Now it's gradually becoming more of a simultaneous process. I certainly have the English almost running like a soundtrack in my mind as I'm writing the Afrikaans. It's almost as if the languages are present simultaneously, or as if the Afrikaans is some sort of translation already. I might call it something like, it's almost like writing in between languages, in a sense.
It seems a really odd decision to write in a language which, as you say, possibly 5 million people in the world speak. No writer sets out to think, oh, I don't really want to sell very many books. Obviously, you've got an eye on publication and book sales. Why choose, when you have access to another language that is spoken everywhere, why choose Afrikaans?
I've been asked that before, and it's a very difficult question for me to answer. I think it's just, whether one wants it or not, it's kind of the language of one's bone, in one's bones. It's the language of one's mother. And there's always a certain, no matter how well one speaks a second language, there's always a sort of an edge, there's a sort of a mar, even if it's only a 2% difference in one's facility in one language or the other. I think that 2% when you write literary fiction, which is extremely language conscious and sentence conscious, that 2% does make a huge difference.
Let's talk about your book now, because although South Africa, the protagonist in it, Etienne, is South African, and South Africa does make an appearance, there is a small section of the book that actually takes place there. In fact, it's largely away from there, although the feeling of the country permeates the book. Tell us about the third reel.
Plot-wise, it focuses on a young South African. It's set in 1986, or it starts in 1986. The young South African, Etienne, lives in the then conservative city of Pretoria in South Africa. He's from a reasonably conservative Afrikaans-speaking world.
So far, so autobiographical.
So far, so autobiographical. The rest of it indeed diverges very substantially, I should say. He then decides to escape South Africa. He flees conscription, as many people did it, many young men did at the time. Only white young men, of course, had to do military service. He flees to London. His father, who's very well connected, is extremely unhappy about his departure. In London, he deals with the End Conscription Campaign people, and they manage to get him into film school. Starts living in a squat. It's the height of Thatcherite Britain, of course. He moves into an artist's squat. Falls in love with a young German artist called Axel. He fails quite miserably at making films, even though he thought it would be his métier. But then he's introduced to a 1930s film, or at least the spectre of a lost 1930s film made by Jewish filmmakers in early Nazi Germany, exactly at the time when it became pretty much impossible for Jewish filmmakers to do anything, and who then had to go underground. At some point, his lover, Axel, goes to Berlin, doesn't return, disappears, and then Etienne decides he will go to Berlin as well, and then embark on this dual search for both this lost film, the reels of this lost film, and his lover, Axel, and then unfolds a rather labyrinthine and complex set of events. He goes as an exchange student to the East Berlin Film School and has free access to both East and West Berlin and crosses back and forth.
And that's really the heart of the book. It's about this crossing backwards and forwards through all sorts of different worlds, isn't it? It's an enormously affecting book, and that sense of place is so absolutely gripping. The film itself, though it's fictional, is actually based on the work of a real person.
Yes, so as you say, it's a fictional film, but supposedly it is a film based on the work by Walter Benjamin's, by the German Jewish intellectual from the 1930s, Walter Benjamin, and it's called A Berlin Childhood around 1900, and it was written by Benjamin just before, in the early stages of the war. And it's an enormously affecting work. They're quite small, dense, complex fragments conjuring up certain atmospheres and textures of the Berlin of Benjamin's childhood. And it was written quite poignantly at a time when Benjamin knew or must have known that the Berlin that he knew as a child would soon disappear, and that he himself might never see it again either.
Very sad story, because he ended up killing himself just on the eve of being able to get away.
Absolutely. He fled the Nazis, was itinerant in Europe for quite a while, and then ultimately tried to cross the border into Spain from France. And in Spain, he would be able to get a boat to the, and escape to the United States. On the very day that he and some others arrived at the Spanish border, at the French-Spanish border, the Spanish had stopped giving visas for Jewish people to cross the border. And they were turned away, and Benjamin was in such despair that he killed himself in that night. And then, ironically, his suicide then prompted the Spanish to once again provide such visas to Jews who were crossing the border. So an extraordinary, unlucky sort of end.
I want to just return to this idea of a divided city and almost a divided mind. You talk about psychogeography. What is that?
It's really, I think, the way that a cityscape interacts with the psychology of its inhabitants. And there's a South African writer, Ivan Vladislavich, who writes quite exquisite works. And it's really in his work that I first came across the term of psychogeography. He writes about the psychogeography, particularly of Johannesburg, another complex city. But that's another matter. So the novel then works very much with Berlin is, in a sense, space is extremely important. Berlin is, in a sense, a character, or it's at least a space without which this specific story cannot happen. And I try to make full use of the complexities of that city and its boundaries at the time. What was quite interesting to me were the ways that the two half cities bled into each other, sort of on the edges. You know, there would be Friedrichstrasse, which was the big border station, which had to house two train systems of both East and West Berlin. One could never cross from one to the other. So there was this really complex system. It was like a termite nest, in a sense, of tunnels and spaces. And then, of course, there were the underground train systems, which had to be severed in a very complex sort of way. One of the West Berlin underground train systems was owned, in fact, by the East Berlin government. And some parts of West Berlin's system ran underneath East Berlin, and then there were ghost stations, of which the entrances on the street level in East Berlin had been closed up. And then there would be these twilight platforms, and West German trains went passing through the platforms where there were East German guards standing, you know, with their shadowy faces and their guns, and the trains would slow down to a crawl. And it was a very spooky spaces, certainly, in the divided cities.
London is obviously a big part of the plot too. It's London of the 80s, it's Margaret Thatcher's London, it's Cold War London, it's gay London, and it's AIDS London.
Yes, it is all those things. The characters I focus on, and the kind of urban lives of I was interested in at this time, are young people squatting, mostly artists. They have, in some ways, they're probably naive, innocent. Their ideas might seem a little bit quaint now, but there's something very attractive to me about these revolutionary ideas, their fantasies about how future urban lives could be, how one could sort of live freely, love freely, make art freely. And at the same time, of course, in parallel, Thatcher's world of rampant materialism and extreme capitalism is developing in the background. When I was writing this novel, someone once asked me on a writer's panel, what am I writing? And I just, without thinking, said, well, I'm writing a queer nostalgia novel. So in a sense, it is a novel of nostalgia for a time when it seemed possible that one could radically change how the future world would be. It was a time of an ideologically bipolar world, and queer life, although it seemed under pressure, seemed as if it could have an exciting future in these cities. And it's quite odd if one think of a place like London or the UK now has gay rights that are far better than they were in the 80s. But at the same time, a city like London and queer life in a city like London has been sterilized to a certain extent. It's far less visible. Of course, London has become a city to a large extent, central London at least, for bankers and lawyers, you know, with hugely high property values. Things are spacey so expensive that gay bars are really closing one after the other. So it is a kind of a sense of nostalgia for a very visible, very complex, very sort of exciting queer urban life of the 80s. Even Berlin, which is still a very queer city in many ways, but has become something of a pastiche of itself, something of a tourist fantasy of itself. And that time of particularly just after, also reunification, when West Berliners were moving into East Berlin and claiming spaces and having sort of wild sex parties in bunkers, you know, that time seems to be over.
You write wonderful sex, I have to say.
Thank you. Someone said there's so much hard and dark sex in it.
But it is. I mean, it's not... I mean, some of it is erotic sex, but a lot of it is sex that means so much else.
I think part of why the sex in the book might feel edgy to people or might even feel extreme. Someone has spoken about the violent sex. I'm not sure it is really violent. Some of the imagery around it might be violent. But I think if you have this odd triangle of these cityscapes, which are scarred cityscapes, which have absorbed the trauma of the 20th century, you can almost not be in those cities without sensing, without feeling the major traumas of the 20th century. So on the one hand, you've got the cityscape, and then on the other hand, you have bodies, you know, and I think that the interaction between the two and the sort of the erotic life in that sort of city seems to be shaped in a certain way by the specific space in which it takes place.
Lots of fabulous art in it too, lots of installations. Axel, who is the lover of Etienne, is this artist who makes this very, really quite bizarre work.
Yes, he uses all kinds of interesting materials, post-mortem Victorian photos of children, of dead children. I presume people generally know about these photos. They were photos taken in the early stages of photography, when photography was very expensive and a lot of people couldn't, in fact, afford taking photographs of their children while alive. So their children would be posed shortly after their deaths for these photographs and be made to look alive. And they're very poignant sometimes. There would be a photograph of twins with one seeming to be sleeping on the shoulder of the other, both dressed in their Sunday best. Or a photograph of a child posed with their favorite toy or with a kitten on the lap. So, so he makes an installation with such photographs. He uses all kinds of things, freshly slaughtered rabbit hearts, the fur of nearly extinct animals and so on.
So his own semen.
His own semen, for that matter, indeed. There's always seems to be lots of art in my novels and lots of people making art, more often than not visual art. And I think there's a certain kind of envy involved in that. I think I would have loved to make visual art or to make films, for that matter. There's filmmaking in this novel, failed filmmaking in this novel as well. To a certain extent, people have crucified me for saying this, but writing sometimes, to me at least, feels like the ugly cousin. You know, I'm envious of people who do things that are so immediately perceivable by viewers. So I think the closest one gets to making art is by writing about making it, or composing music. Some of my short stories have a lot of music in it.
Which you compose yourself?
It's fictional music being composed in the writing, indeed, yes. And of course, having art being made in the work is also quite useful as a mode of pondering the writing process itself, the making of the writing. If one reads some of the commentary in this novel on Etienne's films and what's wrong with them, it's probably quite indicative of how I was feeling about the writing of the novel while I was writing that part. So, yes, it's always a good sort of space for thinking about writing.
Well, I have no doubt, having reinvented yourself from sort of Afrikaans schoolboy to overseas student to New York corporate lawyer, now back to hugely valued South African writer, that there is another reinvention or two or three on the cards.
Well, yes, I think the reinvention bit gets tiring as well.
What is next, though?
I'm writing very productively at the moment. I'm working on two other projects simultaneously. I should perhaps mention that in my personal life, my husband and I are having a child through surrogacy very soon. So I think that parenthood no doubt requires a certain kind of fundamental reinvention, I'm sure. So we'll see how that works out.
Fani, or S.J. Nordea, many thanks. The Third Reel is published by Salt. This conversation took place at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.